You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
It's the final stretch of 2022, and HRN needs your help. Become an HRN member with a donation of any amount at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. Register now for the 2023 conference, featuring more than 90 in-person sessions and 25 virtual sessions on farming and food systems. Learn more at pasafarming.org/conference.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and it is my great pleasure to welcome back Chloe Sorvino, who leads the coverage of food, drink, and agriculture at Forbes. She works on the 30 Under 30 food and drink list and spearheaded Forbes' Ag Tech Summits with signature events in Salinas and Indianapolis. She serves as a steward of the Forbes Union. Her work has been featured by NPR, the Los Angeles Times, and Fast Company. For the Financial Times, she shared a 2014 Best in Business Award in Government Reporting by the Society of American Business Editors and Writers for an investigation detailing the U.S. government's then-running price tag for its conflict in Afghanistan. Titled The Cost of War, it led A1 when it ran on Monday, December 15th, 2014. Sorry to go back into the Wayback Machine. Anyway, Chloe joins me today to talk about her newly published book, Raw Deal: Hidden Corruption, Corporate Greed, and the Fight for the Future of Meat. This is a Simon & Schuster publication via Atria Books. Chloe, congratulations. Great book. Absolutely. From one meathead to another, girl, you knocked this one out of the park.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. And thank you for the extended bio. I appreciate it. Super excited to talk about Raw Deal.
Well, I mean, I'm, you know, you're one of those people that makes me feel incredibly inadequate because.
Oh, please.
Because in 2014, you must have been about 12.
I will not share my age, but just know that I'm a year older than when Upton Sinclair published The Jungle.
Oh, really? Is that right? Okay, then. Well, I don't feel quite as bad, but I still feel bad. Anyway, let's start with what got you interested in the meat space? Because, I mean, you do cover agriculture, food and drink, but that's like a very broad portfolio. So how did meat become your sort of cause du jour?
Yeah, so, you know, I started at Forbes nearly a decade ago, and it was on the billionaires beat where a lot of people start out there. And I was doing the valuations for the lists, the Forbes 400, the World Billionaires list, these signature net worths that you see across the world. And I was doing it in real estate, hedge funds, investing, but I was also then finding myself valuing the Cargill family and Tyson and all these different meat packers, and came to this work through that and seeing how, particularly in the food and agriculture industry, there has been so much concentration of wealth and power in meat. It is the most valuable, and it has the most billionaires that have been able to hoard up money, wealth, and power here. But so, you know, go back to 2017 or 2016, really, I did a reporting trip to Omaha, Nebraska, to visit a billionaire who had carved out a particularly smaller niche. But, you know, it's the scale is really kind of wild. You know, I realized at that point that the top four meat packers controlled 80% plus of the entire beef industry, which is an insane, insane amount. And they had so much, and there was so much consolidation that it made pretty much everyone else have tiny, tiny, tiny percentages. But Henry Davis is this billionaire who was the fifth largest and had about 2% of the industry. And he owned 100% of this small slaughterhouse. And I got to visit it. And it was an eye-opening experience in Omaha.
It's a learning experience. I have also visited a cattle slaughterhouse. I went to a Cargill facility in Colorado. And lucky for me, I got a guided tour with Temple Grandin, but only after shaming them completely, because I had gone as, you know, part of a team from Food Arts Magazine. I don't know if you remember them. And they, all the chefs were allowed to go to the slaughterhouse, but not any, me or my colleague from the magazine, Barb Mathias.
Wow.
And I said to the, you know, the people who were running this tour, which in this case was Certified Angus Beef, I said, well, if you've got nothing to hide, why on earth would you not want me to go in there and take a look at what you're doing? And they thought that one through. And about 3 weeks later, they flew me back out to Colorado. And I got this, you know, soup to nuts tour with Temple as my guide and every department head explaining everything they were doing. And it was, like you said, a really eye-opening experience. And I was deeply grateful to them and to Temple for the experience. Really taught me a lot. But anyway, so let's get right into the business of your book, Raw Deal. So why don't we start by reviewing the obscene profit margins that these, you know, four firms essentially made in the last 3 years while we all grappled with the pandemic. If you have any numbers to share, that's nice to hear. I want to talk about some of the stock buybacks, along with the gigantic increase in exports, which was, you know, basically responsible for much of that profit. And at the same time, as listeners may remember, John Tyson published an op-ed or a full-page ad, I guess it was, in the New York Times saying, our supply chain is broken. We're not going to be able to give you enough meat, you know, even though the freezers are full of meat and these guys are shipping this stuff out as fast as they can. So give us the backstory on all of that.
So much to dive into there. And we can talk about each sector if you want, but really, you know, let's even just start off with Tyson, because that full page ad was a real catalyzing moment for me personally and why I wanted to write this book, because here he was trying to stoke fears and also then further push workers into harm's way, say, hey, keep them on the line. But at the same time, Tyson was exporting more than ever before. Their exports in 2020 were up 43% compared to the year before. They exported 640,000 tons of product around the world. And, you know, let's like break that down, right? Aside from the worker issues there, and aside from, again, stoking fears that there wouldn't be enough food to have Americans eating at their grocery stores, where in reality, there was such an excess that there was a surplus that they were able to get actually then also more money for, and it really helped drive a lot of the profits that they made into 2020. I mean, Tyson made $5 billion in 2020 over that year, an 11.6% margin, which is way, way more than, you know, at the same time, it was this, it's this really outsized number, but then also there had been this trend of these top meatpackers eking out more profits and consolidating their control, which has helped them really take back some share over even just the past 7 years. And so, you know, in the beef industry, for example, Tyson has never really relied on beef to be its most profitable division. That's always usually been chicken. But in the past 5 years, beef has, in part because of a lot of this consolidation that's been driven over the past several years, you know, beef has been crazy in terms of how much you can make on a single cattle head. You know, between 2002 to 2014, the average animal had a loss of $10 on average. But starting in 2015, you start getting $100 per animal in average operating income. So that's crazy. And a total shift that, again, has been able to happen in part because some of these markets have become so uncompetitive. Now there are, you know, cattle is one of the few meat sectors that still has a fair amount of cash purchases happening on the open market. And in some of these areas now, there are only one or two meatpackers that will buy cattle from independents. And that has further driven down prices and dictated what producers are ending up with at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And let's be clear that it's the packers who are making this $100 an animal margin, right? It's not
correct.
The nature.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. I just want to make sure that people understand that, you know, this is, it's not the guys who are out there actually doing the work of, you know, raising these animals. It's the packers who are then, you know, crushing these guys in terms of price per pound that they're willing to give because, as you just said, they control the slaughtering and processing facilities so tightly because of such a tight concentration in the market. Let's talk about for listeners who didn't tune into Chloe a few months ago, when was it that you came on to talk about the Trump administration collusion with the meatpackers in terms of writing that declaration saying that they were essential frontline workers and could not be allowed off of the job? I just want to remind people that there is another episode where you and I talk about one specific aspect of how the administration colluded with these packers to maintain their profit margins. When was that, Chloe? Was that
like we did that in May or June.
Right.
So all around the investigation into how state, local, and federal officials were all working hand in hand with the meat packers to keep them open, keep them having workers on the line getting sick, and keep them profiting. And, you know, at the same time, when there was, you know, lawyers for these companies or their trade groups actually writing executive order drafts and wild.
Yeah, it was wild. So people should go back and listen to that in the wake of listening to this show, because that's a big part of the puzzle. And this, of course, fueled explosive pandemic, episodes of COVID in the towns in which these packing companies exist. Leah Douglas, now at Reuters, but then at Fern, followed this extensively. And that's another place where you can learn a lot about how these workers were exploited. But let's go on. So among the other, jolly little sinecures that they were able to say, they were, because of these giant profit margins, there were stock buybacks, right? They were able to distribute a lot of money back to their shareholders.
Let's talk about that too. So on top of these profits increasing for these companies and the exports increasing, the dividends that Tyson and JBS, these publicly traded meat packers, were giving back to their shareholders, were growing consistently. The yields of these dividends were far more than they really had been before, because they had so much cash to go around with. And at the same time, and these companies were also so cash rich that they were using a lot of that cash to buy back their shares. And what that often does is it ends up raising the stock price in a way. And so these types of kind of big purchases, when you have so much wealth and power accumulated, that's, again, one of the ways that these meatpackers are able then to squeeze out the smaller players.
Right. Very interesting. All right, let's move on for a second, because I want to focus on something that really interested me and which I was not so much aware of. I mean, I've talked a lot about monopolies and the monopolization of agricultural industry across the board, not just in the meat industry, but if you want to talk about equipment or seeds or agrochemicals, all of these are now kind of, concentrated down into three or four or five firms that control. But I've never really thought about the buying part of it. And you had a really interesting section of the book about what is called monopsony. So can you explain what that is and how that skews the industry?
So many Americans have grown up with the game of Monopoly. It's a concept that we're all quite familiar with. But monopsony is just the opposite side of that coin, so to speak. It really just means when there's one, or an oligopsony would be, a small handful of buyers that end up dictating a market. And, just as a meatpacker might have monopoly power because they're selling, it's one or a few sellers to the retailers. The retail industry has become so consolidated, even just in the past decade, that's driven ramifications like bankruptcies of small regional players, lots of M&A, lots of corporate consolidation, all because there are grocers that are struggling to make profits amid the domination of Walmart and then also Amazon. There's some numbers here that can break it down quite clearly. Take the $1 that is spent on meat. Okay. In 1990, a rancher would get 59 cents of that dollar. A meat packer would get just 8 cents, and a retailer would get 33 cents. In 2009, the rancher was already starting to get squeezed, and 42 cents of that dollar was taken. The meat packer only had 9 cents still, and the retailer had taken 49 cents. Now, by 2020, you start seeing the meat packer taking back a fair amount of the share. Now they retain 18 cents, but the retailers also maintained a significant share, 44 cents. And that just meant less and less ending up going to the producer at the end of the day. But this is all important. And you can also think about it from the other perspective, because I first heard about the monopsony problem from actually the meatpacking union, UFCW. I was talking to the head of the meatpacking union, one of the ones that's in most of the meatpacking plants out there. And he said that, we're never going to be able to solve the monopoly problem unless we also solve this monopsony problem. And, you know, when we're in negotiations with the meatpackers at the bargaining table, trying to get a better contract for our workers, trying to get more money and more benefits, stronger benefits, often we're confronted by these meatpackers saying, we can't end up giving you that because we don't have the money. We have to end up selling this stuff so cheap to Walmart, which ends up dictating the price to us. And they've seen plans, and the union had told me about how he's been in plans and seen negotiations where all of a sudden, if the plant doesn't agree to a new stipulation that Walmart gives them, Walmart doesn't need to have that contract. They have pretty much any option of getting meat wherever they want. And they will very easily say, okay, no more contract. And what has to happen? At the end of the day, the plant often closes, or maybe there's significant layoffs. And so, you know, I really wanted to share this part of the story because meatpackers will often say that they're not able to do more to stop consolidation or to stop centralizing because they have to deal at the end of the day with Walmart, which has dominated so much of the grocery industry in just two decades.
Very short space of time. I mean, really in just the last, not even 2 decades, I would suggest. Right?
No, not at all. Yeah. I mean, it really started only exactly 2 decades ago, actually. And but the way that Walmart has then used its power to put harder, tougher stipulations on its meatpackers and on its suppliers, this muscle is like worked in new ways all the time. Different types of requirements, it might seem petty or small, but they add up and they really make a difference. And there are lots of different examples, but at the end of the day, they have potentially a quite imbalanced system.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned one thing like that they were, I hope I understood this correctly, but for example, Walmart during, say, the pandemic, they were applying a surcharge to suppliers of something like 3% if there was any kind of supply chain disruption. So that would, say, for example, have an impact on whether or not you allowed workers to go out on sick leave. Or whether you force them to stay on the line, right? I mean, stuff like that is going to have a really big impact on workers. Let's talk a little bit to go further into that issue. You also described, like I've done quite a few shows around the class action suits for price fixing, with say Tyson, Pilgrim's Pride and so forth, who for all intents and purposes have been given a slap on the wrist. I mean, with the giant profits that you've earlier described, these guys get to pay, you know, $25 million to settle a class action suit because they've been price fixing for the last 15 years in the poultry industry, the beef industry, the hog industry, what have you. But what really struck me was a focus that you had on an organization called WMS. I've now forgotten what that stands for, but it's like the AgriStats. It's sort of the other side of AgriStats, right? Where they're sharing information and these companies are colluding on wage and benefit packages. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. You know, I think folks who are passionate about meat industry or have been following some of this have seen AgriStats talked about in the news over years. Some of these lawsuits, there are hundreds of these different consumer lawsuits or class actions or supplier lawsuits suing meatpackers for allegations of price fixing from some of the biggest names across the food industry, from McDonald's to Wawa to Kraft Heinz to ConAgra to Nestle. Pretty much any retailer or major restaurant chain you can think of has put in some of these claims. And there already have been some significant settlements of upwards of, you know, some $200 million plus. And some of these settlements aren't still, you know, have acknowledging wrongdoing. But the AgriStats model was then, it's a data provider at the end of the day that works with these meatpackers to sell data that each of them then is also sharing data with. And so there's this sharing of information, which the meatpackers are able to pay for, but the smaller producers cannot. And it's created a system where there's been almost a copycatting. And so I wanted to write about the AgriStats and a lot of the price fixing allegations. But then I also wanted to write about how it's not just that. These data providers have been working to make meatpacking essentially, you know, data on a in a formula on a spreadsheet. And pretty much every single aspect of how this business works, you know, these meatpackers have been trying to figure out ways to make things even more efficient over time. And data providers like WMS, which is a Pennsylvania company called Weber, Meng, and Shaw, named for the three partners who there are there. It's a tiny company of only a handful of folks who work there. And WMS, pretty much their almost entire business was doing an annual survey for the HR departments of many of the top poultry companies. And this was a scheme that went on from 2000. Mm. And this essentially was a mass compensation survey with the goal of subjugating workers, keeping their pay as low as possible, keeping their annual salaries, their employment benefits, their healthcare benefits, all of these different aspects of compensation, which are crucial. And by the way, again, horribly marginalized workers, extremely vulnerable workers, also working some of the most dangerous jobs in this country.
Yeah.
So that's taken in aside, right? But then, you know, I was just so blown away reading these thousands of pages of documents of lawsuits and different testimony that have come out over the past few years. And, you know, I should also mention, aside from the lawsuits that I write about with WMS, the DOJ has been investigating wage fixing, you know, as this case has developed and accelerated just since I started following it even. But some of the things that have come out are quite stark and really paint a picture. And I want to share because, you know, it wasn't just data that was being shared with different HR folks about, you know, how to pay workers. It was then a survey that was then discussed at these secret roundtable meetings held often in Destin, Florida. And it went beyond kind of typical collusion where, you know, obviously these executives were in these meetings, sharing this data, discussing it in depth for hours, but then they were also, you know, doing social events together as well. This group, this compensation scheme group was then choosing between excursions at one point. I loved this data. They had to choose between an excursion of a 5-hour party fishing trip, a tiki bar boat ride, or a dolphin boat cruise, because they didn't have enough time to do this alleged collusion when they were in their conference rooms in Florida together. They had to also get out on the water, get out in the open and continue bonding that way.
Whoa. I mean, you know, they all do it. And it's not unique to the meat industry, but honestly, it is just mind-blowing that these fat cats are sucking on these big salaries. And meanwhile, the guys who are actually making the profits for them are lucky to get, you know, 3 days of paid sick leave. I mean, the whole way that we approach labor in the agricultural sector, and I suppose elsewhere, but especially there where it's like the lowest paying jobs, the most dangerous jobs, you're exposed to chemicals, you know, scary machinery, people lose fingers and arms and legs, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And there's no protection for them and they don't get paid for it. So I just wanted people to like really dial in on that aspect of it because it's just yet another, you know, head smacker. We have to take a short break for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Chloe Sorvino talking about the raw deal. Please stay tuned for much, much more.
It's the final stretch of 2022 and HRN needs your help. Our goal for the winter membership drive is to raise $30,000. Become an HRN member with a donation of any amount at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Through creative, educational reporting, storytelling, and live events, HRN delivers thought-provoking exchanges about the real issues affecting our global food system. Your donation also supports our internship program, an essential part of HRN's work that educates the next generation of journalists. Donate at the $90 level before December 31st, and you'll receive a limited release HRN t-shirt designed exclusively for HRN members by artist Chema Scandal. When you become an HRN member at any level, you'll be the first to know about special events and get news updates created only for Food Radio Insiders. Help us meet our end-of-year fundraising goal with your tax-deductible donation. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and become a member today.
Cultivate farms and food systems that nourish, heal, and empower. Register now for PASA Sustainable Agriculture's 2023 conference. Access more than 100 sessions on topics including environmental conservation, food justice, sustainable food and textile production, renewable energy, and much more. Featuring a not-to-be-missed lineup of speakers, including Indigenous environmental scientist and author of Fresh Banana Leaves, Jessica Hernandez, Scottish farmer and co-producer of the podcast Landed, Cole Gordon, best-selling author of The Art of Fermentation, Sandor Katz, co-owners of heritage seed company True Love Seeds, Owen Taylor and Chris Bolden Newsom, and many more. There are two ways to attend, virtually or in person. PASA's virtual conference takes place January 17th through 19th. Join from anywhere. PASA's in-person conference is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on February 8th through 11th and includes social and networking events plus an expansive trade show. Register now at pasafarming.org/conference. That's pasafarming.org/conference.
Okay, let's move on to the Batista brothers. For people who don't know and haven't followed this, the Batista brothers are behind the largest meat company in the world, also known as JBS. And they acquired the Swift Company, which was one of our big packers, I guess about 25, 30 years ago, and then went on a tear of acquiring medium and large scale meat packers over the last 15, 20 years, right?
And the not even just that, though, I will say. It's actually only a decade.
Oh,
yeah. It's 2008 was the Swift acquisition.
Oh, is that right? Jeez, I didn't realize that. So, and the way they did that was to basically make the Bank of Brazil their cash cow, right? And the way they did that was through kickbacks and bribes. Talk a little bit about how they managed this remarkable transition from sort of, you know, your average, not that big company to really the giant of the world that they are now.
The story of JBS cannot be understated because it is just such a wild saga.
It is.
And at the end of the day, these completely absurd elements that you think almost would exist in, you know, a high speed chase documentary series or movie, like a, you know, like an Ocean's 8 type deal. At the end of the day, these wild facts have all then led to what in America? Further consolidation, producers continuing to get squeezed, workers continuing to be put in harm's way. And now a company that has these, you know, all these instances of ill-gotten gains and different bribery that have been able to use that money and a part of it anyway to fund a lot of these acquisitions and fund the further consolidation. Also, you know, putting out meat and importing a lot of meat that's linked to devastation of deforestation in the Amazon, importing that to the U.S. when we already have so much meat already made here. I mean, there's so many different ramifications and aspects of this, but I can go into a little bit just to break it down. You know, there are these two brothers, Joesley and Wesley Batista. They ended up taking over their father's small meat company. It started out as a really tiny family butcher in Brazil, and then it grew over time. And these brothers took this over with the ambitions of making JBS a global powerhouse. And that's exactly what they've done. It's now the world's largest meat packer. It's dominating in beef, pork, and chicken in the U.S. is pretty much the second top player. But, you know, just also kind of on that antitrust line, one more acquisition could maybe even put them over and make them even overtake Tyson at any second, really. But so in Brazil, Joesley particularly had this relationship with the finance minister and some loan officers at BNDES, the state-funded bank. And they were having a kickback arrangement for years just to get, you know, preferential access to different meetings. And eventually those meetings are part, again, there are some 30 plus different bribery allegations that they were ended up getting charged with, but this is just one of the main ones. So this finance minister was helping them get these loans. And some of those loans or some of these business deals, eventually BNDES also took it equity in JBS itself and did several other loan deals or financing deals to help fuel this acquisition spree in the U.S. Probably one of the most aggressive acquisition sprees ever in the U.S. by any, you know, foreign company or otherwise. It's not just Swift. Swift was their first iconic acquisition.
Right.
But
Pilgrim's Pride, chicken. They bought National Beef, right? Is that right?
They didn't buy National, but they tried to. And that was one of the few cases that the regulators did have antitrust scrutiny over. And they said they couldn't do it. That's actually why they ended up buying Pilgrim's Pride instead. But Pilgrim's Pride itself is a fascinating case I would actually love to go into, because they now own 80% of it. When they started out, they actually bought up 64% of it out of bankruptcy. Pilgrim's Pride was really struggling. And that is one of those other clear instances where BNDES talked about how they were helping fund this acquisition. And through some of the documents I found and through a lot of the Department of Justice investigation, the SEC investigation that ended up happening into the Batista brothers, it came out that for the Pilgrim's Pride acquisition, the finance minister himself actually got a $55 million bribe. And not only was that bribe specifically for the Pilgrim's Pride acquisition, but it was also specifically deposited into a U.S. bank account.
Nice.
And so it was a U.S. bank account that still has not really come out what bank. And I've been trying to figure out what bank has been helping these folks. But, you know, there are... It's not just that, you know, this finance minister and Joesley Batista did some meetings in the U.S. Some of these other bribes ended up transferring a $1.5 million U.S. apartment actually in Manhattan. And then there are a lot of other crazy
things traded too. Like, I remember.
Yeah, there was a helicopter traded. There was a 3% stake in the concession stand of a soccer stadium that had once had the World Cup at it. There are fake invoices of cattle purchased. I mean, they went above and beyond to hide some of these bribes, because not only were these bribes specifically for these businesses, but at the end of the day, this finance minister kind of came back knocking, and all of these, this kickback fund that Batista's had been holding in these accounts for the minister ended up having then to be deployed. And he came calling around Brazil's 2014 elections and ended up using this slush fund, which, by the way, also through other documents had, you know, been at some points commingled with publicly traded Pilgrim's Pride's accounts. Even wow. There was commingling of these slush funds. You know, what you ended up having was just, I mean,
it's mind-blowing. It really is mind-blowing. And what makes it even more mind-blowing, and we only have about 10 or so minutes left to go, and I just want to get at this, that the JBS does a lot of business with the United States federal government. And Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut seems to be the only person who is saying anything about, first of all, let's also point out that JBS meat has been stopped at the border numerous times in the last 4 or 5 years for either it's rotten, literally rotten meat, or it's tainted with hoof and mouth disease, or the most recent was BSE, which is also known as mad cow disease. And so, and yet the federal government continues to extend these large buying contracts to them. And I want you to, if you can, tell people like how much these contracts are worth, or and where the meat goes from those federal contracts. And then we'll talk about why there's no apparent scrutiny of this.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest aspects here of how they continue to find JBS entrenched through different parts of the federal government and being supported, continue to be supported and incentivized through through the federal government. Not only did they get $100 million as a trade aid package about 7 years ago, they also continue to get millions and millions of dollars through contracts for public school lunches, institutional lunches, like for nursing homes or different federally funded prisons. And these contracts are significant. And while they've hit, you know, in 2019, there was more than 100 million even given just through some of these public school contracts. But in 2021, it was 38 on JBS or Pilgrim's Pride meat purchase. And that was specifically even $6.5 million for pork, actually even earmarked through Biden's like Build Back Better economic agenda, specifically earmarked for that. And so, you know, you see DeLauro going to Vilsack and specifically asking, why are we still using federal procurement to support and subsidize this foreign corrupt owned meat packer? And, you know, at the end of the day, Vilsack has blown these suggestions off and these criticisms off. And what we've seen as the response has been continued support of JBS, especially through these contracts.
Well, it is astonishing. We are paying for this, people. Taxpayer money. This is taxpayer money going to fund, first of all, a company that has no need of any help. Secondly, they're very busy squashing our own meat production, and they get to bring their meat in, and somebody grinds it in an American machine, and it gets labeled as a product of the USA, which is what all American meat, you know, all American meat producers are freaking out over the fact that we can't reinstate country of origin labeling, or the country of origin labeling is so lax as to allow for that kind of, you know, shifty, sketchy sort of, you know, business as usual kind of a deal. I mean, it's just, it is an incredible story, I think. I mean, the whole Batista Brothers saga is both fascinating and horrifying.
It's a cautionary tale, and that's why I wanted to write about it, because there are other foreign billionaires that are polluting our environment, who are hurting workers and are exporting and making a lot of profits. And JBS is an extreme example, but...
Right. Smithfield is another great example of that. The Obama administration, the CFI USA, or whatever,
CFIUS.
So this is, for people who don't know, this is a sort of secretive organization within the government. It's a committee. It's a committee for foreign investment in the U.S. And they're supposed to vet sales of things like selling American agricultural assets to foreign nationals. And for whatever reason, they very rarely bring the hammer down and say no. So I got interested in that topic myself a few years ago when Smithfield was sold to Chinese. And, you know, everybody calls it the WH Group. That's actually just an arm of the Chinese government. The Chinese government controls everything. So it's, you know, it's not like it's a different for-profit entity. Not that it really matters, but it's like, I mean, we're really, it's like we're giving away the store here. We're giving them our water. We're giving them our feed supplies. We're giving our environment away. They own 1 in 4 pigs in the United States, Smithfield Company does. And we own the dead pigs in the manure.
And I mean,
stopping this.
No, it's astronomical. And there have been calls for years and years. Part of the reason I wanted to write this book is because I've seen the letters being written to Janet Yellen and other federal regulators begging for CFIUS investigations into the Batista's investments. They still own some 250 companies in 30 countries. And when you talk about Smithfield, I mean, there's also the billionaire Wen Long, who's the major owner. And not only, it is obviously, of course, backed by the state, but you also see crazy dividends that Wen Long has gotten in 2020. He was making more than $100 million in his annual dividend payment to himself. And that's the problem. You know, there's a lack of incentives to end up supporting better sustainable production. And are these billionaires going to be the ones that really want to put their money where their mouth is when, you know, the climate crisis gets even worse? I mean, that's really the issue I see here. Is Wen Long, was the Chinese state government going to have any interest whatsoever in making pork production more sustainable and making the actual drastic changes we need in the next few years before 2030 makes everything already impossible to change? I don't know.
Yeah, right. I very unlikely. Meanwhile, the Chinese, for people who aren't paying attention, are building these hotels for their pigs. Chloe, you've been on top of this, right?
New CAFOs.
Yeah, I mean, it's just astonishing. Like, or you can raise like 50 or 100,000 pigs in one, you know, 15-story unit. I mean, it's, you know, and of course, even in China, they also do not have any way of managing their effluent there. So they're confronting the same issues that we are, only writ even larger. You know, I mean, it's like you want to talk about water pollution, soil degradation, et cetera. Anyway, we are going to have to wrap it up in about 5 minutes or so. I mean, we don't have to, but I just feel like people get bored, so I don't want to go on. But I do want to talk. One thing I was curious about, you said JPS is publicly traded, but is it listed on the stock exchange?
No, I wrote about how JBS has been trying to go public again, and they've tried it at different points over their past decade of gaining all this wealth. Because the Swift acquisition happened 2008. By 2011, already more than 70% of JBS's total revenues were coming from the U.S. So it has all these different assets now in the U.S., and they've been trying to figure out a way to monetize that, either spinning it off as a U.S. spin-off of just the U.S. assets, or having the entire JBS company relist in the U.S. And that's also part of why you've seen them trying to clean up and making, I think, more settlements or different agreements with the federal government over some of these allegations, more than some of the other meatpackers, because at the end of the day, they want to clean up the accounts as they try to go public. And it's been pulled back even several times. They've been talking about it even just for the past 2 years, but they always kind of seem to get pulled back into another scandal.
And what would be the implications for the industry if they do acquire that listing on the New York Stock Exchange and go public again?
A JPS U.S. listing would really be a one-time chance to reset the governance standards for the long term of the company and infuse it with credibility. And I need to be clear about what I mean by that, because would it actually be credible? What are you really investing in? But I think it'd be a way to almost, greenwash the credibility of the company and to really kind of corporatize it once and for all. And there are folks that say that maybe that would be best for JBS to have that additional public scrutiny. But then there's also the question of shareholder returns. And whenever you're a publicly traded company, you have a fiduciary duty to continue to make more profits and to continue to make higher returns each quarter for your shareholders. And if not, they're have the ability to sue you. There are short sellers that will come after you, the whole bit. And that is a big deal, because there is this fundamental incongruousness between a meatpacker continuing to grow more meat, continuing to increase demand, continuing to increase, while at the same time, we really need the opposite to happen. But then there would be this legal force and a legal reasoning for them to be able to say, no, we have to keep increasing our meat production. We have to keep polluting. We have to keep taking up water where we shouldn't be. And that could have lasting ramifications that drastically changes how these next 30 years could go.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to talk about breaking up the four firm concentrations and stuff, but I think what we're going to do now is, first of all, talk about the fact that you're going to come back in January, early February, to talk more about this issue of consolidation, but then also to talk about lab-grown meat and meat alternatives like Beyond Burger, all of those new players in the meat field, including being produced by Tyson and some of the other big players in the real meat world. And that to me is just a fascinating story in and of itself. I was riveted by that part of the book, I have to say. But now I want you to have a chance to promote yourself shamelessly. Where can people can buy the book everywhere, obviously. Do you have more events? Is there a website you want to direct people to? Let's blow you up a little bit here.
Raw Deal is available wherever books are sold. Go get it at your local indie if they haven't gotten it in stock yet. Ask for it. That would be awesome. But the tour will be going on, especially into 2023. We'll be doing an event with Farm to People in Brooklyn in early January, and then we'll be hitting the West Coast a bit into the spring. And I'm just really excited to get Raw Deal out there. It's been a massive effort from drawing from years and years of my reporting.
Yeah.
And I'm ready to really share it all with the world.
Well, the world is really needs to read this book. People buy this for all of your friends who eat meat. Not to say don't eat meat, but just think about where you're buying it and who you're buying it from. And I'm not naive enough to think that the way consumers spend their money is going to change this issue. But I do think that the more people are aware of what is happening in this sector of the agricultural industry, the more we can vote for legislation that will hopefully break up some of these monopolies, alter some of the buying practices, and generally improve the meat supply, as well as the fate of the workers who do so much to get the food onto our table every single day. So that's my, that is my interest, is rectifying or leveling that playing field. I hate using the cliche, but that's really what it is. It's like people have to get paid. The ranchers need to get paid. The poultry workers, the hog raisers, they all need to get paid. The people who cut it up have to get paid. We have to do something about the way this industry is skewed towards just a few lucky people who were smart enough to do what they do. Anyway, Chloe, thank you so, so much for joining me today. Have a wonderful holiday. Good luck with the book. And I'll be in touch. We'll be talking to you in January.
Can't wait to come back. So much more to talk about.
You betcha. All right, Dahl. Thank you so much. And thank you to my sponsor, as always. See you next time, folks. Have a great week. Thanks for tuning in today. What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.